Well, good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show on March 7th. Good morning. This is Julie Calamine of The Morning Show. And as you would normally expect, another voice today of Phil Huff. Phil's rich, velvety voice and sharp intellect will not be joining us today because he is away. So it's just me. We've got a special treat today, though, and the topic for this morning's morning show is local sustainable farming and gardening in Sandpoint. And we'll have three local farmer gardeners joining us to talk about that. Today's morning show will be a little bit different in that we pre-recorded this show. One of our guests, in addition to Phil, was not able to be live this morning, so we will have a pre-recorded show. That'll be coming on in a few minutes. You are listening to 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. And for those of you who are not able to hear the entire show this morning, it will be posted as a podcast later on today or tomorrow. So know that if you can't hear it all, you'll be able to listen to it later on via our website, which is krfy.org. Before we go into the interview, let's hear about the weather for today and into the next couple of days. Well, if you're hoping for spring to arrive, that is not going to happen quite yet, because today we're looking at heavy snow, 90% chance, high of 35. More snow later today, heavy snow and a low tonight of 28. Looks like more of the same tomorrow, high of 39 and a 30% chance of snow, and then 50% chance of snow tomorrow night, Wednesday night. The only change we're going to be seeing for the next several days is that the snow will be shifting to wetter, rainier kind of weather, but looks like we're going to have lots of overcast skies and precipitation through the rest of the week. So, not spring yet, but it's on its way. You can feel it coming. I'm going to introduce our morning show and introduce the guests that we're having this morning, and then I'm going to let the pre-recorded show take it away. Our guests this morning are local dairy farmer Paul Herndon of Pleasant Meadow Creamery. He's a dairy farmer, Guernsey cow dairy farmer, and a family operation. The next guest is a local CSA farmer, farmers market participant, and an educator. Her name is Diane Green. She's with Green Tree Naturals. She's been around a long time in the area. And our third guest is also a local CSA farmer, also a farmers market participant, and she's a growing, no pun intended, seed saver. Her name is Pat von Valkenburg, and she brought along her new farm manager, whose name is Tanner Williams, bright young gentleman, just beginning to work with Pat. They work together at Bountiful Organics. So those are our three guests, and I was joined by co-host Susie Prez. You all know Susie from The Morning Show. So with that, I'm going to begin the morning pre-recorded morning show, and I'll be in touch with you when it's finished. Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday morning show with Julie Calamine and our guest host this morning, Susie Prez. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, Julie. It's really nice to be here.
Thank you for joining me. Phil is out of town, so he won't be joining us for what is a pre-recorded interview. We've got a great interview this morning, and the topic is sustainable food, local food in the Sandpoint community. And I'm joined by three people who are really doing that. We're joined by a local dairy farmer named Paul Herndon with Pleasant Meadow Creamery. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. We have a CSA farmer, among many other things that she does, Diane Green from Green Tree Naturals. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Very happy to have you. And finally, we have Pat von Valkenburg and her farm manager, Tanner, and you're going to have to tell me your last name, Tanner. I've only got Tanner.
Tanner Williams.
All right. And Pat and Tanner are from Bountiful Organics. So really three folks who've been here a while and been doing local sustainable gardening. We're going to have a great conversation about that. Because we have so much to talk about, I'm just going to get us started right away. So I'd like to begin by having you tell us about yourselves, your backgrounds, how you came to be on your farm. So why don't we start with you, Paul?
Okay, so I'm Paul with Pleasant Meadow Creamery. We are a local Guernsey dairy. That's a type of cow. We produce whole milk currently. A2 is a protein type that we are known for, that Guernseys are known for also. And we've been doing this since about 2011 is when we got our first cow. We started actually with dairy goats several years prior to that.
And you're a family farm.
Yes, we are. It's a all hands on deck operation every day of the year.
There you go. And there's more you'll have to tell us about this dairy farm because it's really a unique one. But we'll begin with that and introduce everyone and move along. Diane, tell us about your origins. They go way back.
I came to Idaho in 1974 for work with the Forest Service and worked around the Panhandle area for almost 18 years. Always traveling in between my time of working with the Forest Service as a seasonal. When I came to Sandpoint, I transferred here with the goal of starting a native plant nursery, found my land, found the farm in 1986. And about 4 weeks after I found the farm with my goals going one direction, I met this wonderful man, got married. So we're celebrating our 29th year this year. And Tom was a farmer from Michigan. He hadn't been farming in a long time, but that was his dream. So we shifted and started growing food and have been farming there ever since.
Organically,
which is great. Yeah, we're a certified organic farm. We certified in 1992.
Yes, that's wonderful. Well, Pat, why don't you tell us about your beginnings? And actually, why don't you tell us where you're located too, and I'll ask the others to do the same.
Hi, we're located, Bountiful Organics is out by Shepherd Lake in Sagal. We bought our land back in 1984, totally forested land, had no interest in being a farmer at that time. Actually, a job injury led me to what I'm doing now. I just started doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that and kept adding a little bit more of this and that, and pretty soon we had a certified organic farm.
It's funny how gardening will go that way, isn't it?
It's a blessing. It really is.
And Tanner, how did you come to be with Pat? I understand you're a new addition to the farm.
Yeah, my name's Tanner Williams. I grew up here in Sandpoint, graduated from the local high school in 2011. Growing up from a young age, I was fortunate enough to spend a significant amount of time outside, which connected me to the natural world. Whether it was hiking in the Selkirks or swimming in Lake Pendere, I always admired the beauty and power of nature. After high school, I traveled for a few years and wasn't particularly stoked on school. When I was living abroad, I noticed how influential globalization was. Food was one of the factors of globalization that intrigued me the most. So after I returned home, I decided to go back to school and study agriculture. I attended and graduated from the Evergreen State College, which is located in Olympia, Washington. There, I was exposed to new agricultural ideas and was given the freedom to explore my interests, which all resided in small-scale ag. Once I graduated from school, I came home to regroup and reassess my goals. That's when I met Pat. I volunteered a few days and realized I still had a lot to learn, and what better place to develop my farming skills than back here in Sandpoint.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a great beginning. And you're new, but you're going to learn a lot with Pat, and I think she'll learn a lot from you, too.
Yeah, it's been going great.
Yeah, wonderful. So I'm also interested. Well, first of all, please let us know, Diane and Paul, where y'all are located.
So Pleasant Meadow Creamery is located on Otts Basin Road, which is out in Sagal off of Dufert, past Round Lake State Park. We retail our milk in Sandpoint, off the farm, in Hayden, and in Coeur d'Alene right now. And we're growing exponentially. And I would expect eventually our milk will probably be available down in Moscow and maybe as far as Lewiston.
That leads on to the next question. But first, Diane, where are you located?
We're northeast of town, about 12 miles from town on Rapid Lightning Road, quarter mile past the Pack River store.
So kind of all, well, kind of all over north and south of town. You're all around Sandpoint. Well, this type of farming is growing in the area, and I'm interested in hearing from you all why the local sustainable approach. I've heard from Tanner why it's important to you, but I'd like to hear from the other three of you why the local sustainable approach has been important to you.
Okay, so speaking for us, the way we got into dairy farming, because I don't think there are too many people who rationally and sanely choose to be dairy farmers. It's actually really hard work. And there are a lot of factors in it that are completely out of your control. It takes intensive management. So it would be a tough thing to choose to do. I would say it chose us, and the way we got into it, and the reason I believe in sustainable local farming is, as most people who really study where their food comes from and really study what's good for you, our own family did that, and we've been consuming certified organic food as a family for years, way before we ever started farming. When we moved up here to Bonner County, we decided, well, we should try to find good local products whenever and wherever we could. And at the time, there actually weren't any local dairies. In fact, the ones, if you go to Winter Ridge and Sandpoint and you look at all the local dairies that are on the shelf, none of those existed in 2004. They've all started much later than that. And in fact, all of the grade A dairies in Bonner County are now completely gone. We'll be certified grade A dairy in 2018. So we'll be a new one.
Yeah.
So we were looking for a local source of raw milk and couldn't find any, which necessitated buying our own goats. Goats are sort of like toys for dairy. They don't produce enough. They just whet your appetite. And so eventually we got rid of the goats and got a real dairy producing machine that would be a cow. Oh. So that's how we got into it. And
you had to grow your own. You couldn't exactly find it out there, and you cared about food.
Well, I'm intrigued. I understand it started as a let's take care of the family sort of thing. What made you move towards the Guernsey cows? How are they different with the whole milk? You mentioned something with some numbers. But the bigger question is, or another curious question is, how many cows and how much milk per day? And then how do you sustain that level of work?
Okay, so the reason we got interested in Guernsey cows is in the 1950s, Guernseys were the second most common cow in the United States, and they are a great cow for grass-based dairying. They produce a golden-colored product when they're on grass, which is the old trademark was Golden Guernsey, and Guernseys have been on the decline ever since because the United States went to the Holstein cow because it's a high-volume producer, and producers in big ag were only getting paid for volume, not quality. Guernseys are originated from the island of Guernsey, which is in the English Channel Islands, and there's another island called Jersey. So that would be where your Jersey cows come from. Jerseys are kind of small. Guernseys are bigger, nice-sized cow. They do very well on grass. That's how we selected them. And I think I answered most of that.
And what about those numbers? We can't spend a long time on that, but just
Volume,
quick.
Right? Number of cows.
That, but also the A1, A2, just briefly.
Exactly. So, first of all, we started with one cow, and the way we decided to go commercial was even with one cow, one good cow on grass in the summertime can produce 9 gallons a day, and so or up to 10. And so, obviously, that's more than you need, and it's all machine milking. And so that's more than you need for a family of four, which is what we had at the time. And so we started selling to friends. And then you realize the demand that's out there. There's huge pent-up demand for the product. We're still not able to keep up with the demand curve. It's way ahead of us as far as the supply. So we've been adding Guernseys ever since. We actually have a lot of heifers on the property right now. Heifers are cows before calving, and we're slated. Right now, we have four or five milkers that are in a rotational system, as in they're not all lactating at the same time. We will have 8 at toward the end of the year and 16 in about 2 years.
Okay, so growing. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll pass on the A1, A2 question for the moment. We'll let Diane and Pat answer the same question about. And the question is, if we'd like to remember what that question was, why is local and sustainable important to you all? Diane, what made you make that move toward that kind of farming and gardening?
The first garden I ever had was 1970, which shows reflects my age a little bit. And I learned to grow organically then, and it was on a farm in Missouri. And starting out, having someone be an advocate and very serious about the importance of organic, that was the foundation that I started with. So it was always there. I never experimented with any other way of growing than organically. And with the commitment to organically, when I think about the big picture of what's happening environmentally, organically gives me an opportunity to make the commitment to be a good steward of the land that I'm in charge of. It gives me an opportunity to practice conservation in a way that I can make a difference. And when I'd rather look at what I can do than what I can't. And this is one thing that I can do, is take care of the land that I have and do it in a good way that I'm practicing good stewardship. The sustainable approach to farming means looking closely at food production, using farming techniques that protect the environment, promote the soil, minimize water use. And for us, it's a part of the sustainability factor is being able to make a living at what we do. So it's important for us to be good land caregivers and stewards, but we couldn't do this if we didn't have the community support buying what we grow. So,
well, right on. And Pat, how about you? Tell us, answer the same question for us.
Well, I don't know any different way of farming. I'll go back to the 60s, Diane. You could too, but I played in the dirt. That was my thing growing up. I had no interest in being inside. Dolls were of no interest to me. You put clothes on, you take them off, you're done. Whereas if you're out on the earth, there's just was so much more to do. And as far as what's going on now, we all have to really take a look at what we're doing to this planet and what we're not doing to this planet. And we have to protect it in every way that we can. And even if you only have your little backyard or if you have 50 to 1,000 acres, we all have to do our part and keep our slice clean and pure. Mother Earth is being destroyed in so many ways, but we can all do our part. As far as being certified organic, that for me is more for my customers that might need that assurance. As I mentioned, I don't know any other way to grow, but that's more for I can't think of the word.
Maybe the confidence level for customers.
For those that might want to see our, we have a certificate and we're inspected, and we have records that account for every teaspoon of bone meal or anything that we do to the soil, whether it's weeding or adding nutrients. We document every bit of that. And so it's just really important that we all do our part, whether you're certified or not. Just we've got to love the earth more.
Yeah, there you go. So the old adage, a rising tide lifts all boats, of course, that's not generally agreed upon as a concept in economics, but would you say it applies to sustainable farmers? Does more locally sourced food help consumers and farmers alike? Does having more businesses around you create more demand, or what are you finding? Tanner?
I don't know if sustainable farming applies to our capitalistic concept of economics. Currently, the only social responsibility a business has is to make a profit. Until that ethical framework of our economic system changes, I find it hard to apply it to sustainable farming. I would say locally sourced food changes how consumers interact with farmers, which I believe is a good thing.
Yeah, I would say so too. Paul?
I'd like to also pick up on the point of sustainable. We've talked, Diane actually brought it up. There's two aspects of sustainable. One has to do with how we're caring for the land and whether that land is going to produce in the future. And I would say local sustainable means from inputs that are local, as opposed to bringing in chemicals, et cetera, from the outside, from some big chemical company. But Diane also hinted at economic sustainability. The reality is, in the dairy world and in big ag in general, our model in the United States is a commodity-based model that depends on volume. And even at volume, large dairies in California that are 1,000-plus cows, 10,000 cows, are still losing money because the price of the product is so low. It's pegged at a federal price. It's not a free market. Locally, you're going to charge for your product what the consumer is willing to pay for it. And hopefully you, as the producer and the consumer, can agree on a price that makes me want to get up and milk cows the next year, or makes Diana want to go out into her field next year. And that's part of what sustainability means. Can we continue doing this? Is it worth getting up to do tomorrow? Because I can actually make a living at it, or maybe I can have employees and other families can be supported by our venture.
Yeah, relationship-based then to mm-hmm. a large degree.
Well, small farming is all about relationships. Local food is all about relationships, because it's those people at the farmer's market, those people that are buying and asking for locally sourced food at the restaurants, those people that are coming to patronize farm stands and supporting us at the farmer's market. It's the long-term relationships that we establish with those people, that they know that they can buy good food, good certified organic food that's safe, that's fresh, that's more nutritious. And a part of that goes along with when you talk about the all rising tide lifts all boats. The more farmers, when we first started at the farmer's market, there were 6 or 8 of us. So this is my 26th or 27th year at the farmer's market. And as the market has grown and we've had more and more growers come in, it certainly brings more customers. And that makes a difference.
Yeah, so it is hopefully helping. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to 88.5 KRFY-FM. It's community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. And we're joined this morning by 3 local sustainable gardener/farmers. And those are Paul Herndon from Pleasant Meadows Creamery, Pat Van Valkenburg, she's an organic CSA farmer with Bountiful Organics, and Diane Green, who's also an organic CSA farmer with Green Tree Naturals. So we've been talking about why it's so important, why it's helpful for the earth, and that it's a relationship-based business for our local folks. What I'd like to ask you next is, why might those of us who don't already buy or choose organic or grass, as in Paul's case, grass-fed dairy, why might we choose this type of food over the more modestly priced foods that we would find at the local grocery? Pat?
Well, I can speak for our farm. I know one of your questions was, is it affordable? And the answer is yes. You really can't afford not to start caring about your diet. Our produce is harvested and sold within 24 hours, and you get the maximum nutrition, the maximum shelf life, and there just is zero waste. Our stuff stores amazingly long, and even all of our produce, our garlic stores up to and over a year, for instance, and other produce is picked days or even weeks prior. It's shipped on trucks for sometimes thousands of miles, and it matters. It degrades every moment after that produce is harvested.
We know that, right? Vitamins, everything.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah. So it makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that it might cost a little more, but it's worth more, or is that where you're going with that?
I can only speak for my farm, and I feel that our prices are very fair. I don't go around and look at anyone else's prices. I set a price that I think would be fair if I were buying it.
Back to the relationship thing. If it's a fair price for the customer and you can come back next year, it works.
Right. And
oh, and Tanner wants to add a comment.
Yeah, I believe people will start to take into account how their money perpetuates food systems. As a consumer, we're pretty limited in variety when it comes to shopping for food at the supermarket. Vertical integration or the monopolizing of the food system has influenced U.S. farm policy, which directly benefits large-scale agro companies. With that in mind, excuse me, when we purchase food from these large corporations that have modestly priced foods, we are supporting the farming practices, farm labor practices, etc. And I can only speak for our farm. As a certified organic farm, we do not spray harmful agrochemicals on our crops. We do not use GMOs. We treat our farmers fairly and justly. We also offer open farm hours every Wednesday from 4 to 7. So if anything is in question with your purchase, you as a consumer can go directly to the farm and see what's up.
That's a big plus. Diane?
I absolutely agree with what Pat said. I mean, you think about that. Have you ever tasted a strawberry from the grocery store and wondered why it doesn't taste like a strawberry? How about a tomato? Tomato at the grocery store, they are tasteless. And the reason for that is because they were harvested and unripe so they could make the travel journey. 1,500 miles is the average food distance for a lot of foods that we buy. If they're shipping it from California, by the time it gets here, it's already 5 days old. Most of the local food we can guarantee our customers, and I'm sure it's the same for most of us that harvested within 24 hours of bringing it to market, that it will last about 10 days if it's kept cool and stored properly. That's pretty average. So if a strawberry is picked unripe in California and makes it up here, there's a reason why on day 9 it goes on sale and turns into a container of mold.
And we haven't even discussed varieties, which we may get to at some point, but I imagine you're growing much different plants and products than we will find in the grocery store. And wow, the difference in local fresh milk versus store milk. Pop.
So, and we are in store. So we are, I always like to say to people, hey, we're store milk too. But the difference is, when you go to get our milk at Winter Ridge, if you show up on the day that we deliver there, you are getting milk that came out of the cows either that morning or the day before. If you're one of our on-farm customers, you're getting milk that came out of the cows that morning or the day before. It's as fresh as it can be. It's raw. That means it's not pasteurized. It's not homogenized. It's in glass containers, which is an inert container. And the shelf life on it is actually pretty amazing. If we do everything right, our milk will last over 21 days. But we believe in a local model there because not pasteurizing and not having control over a large distribution chain where we can control the temperature the milk's kept at throughout the whole chain. We believe in only distributing over a certain distance, and I believe that's the way the milk market and vegetable market and everything else should be.
All right, Susie.
Well, I do have a couple questions. Pat, you mentioned that you have farm hours. There's the relationship between the farmer and the customer, or the consumer, we might call it. And we've mentioned a couple times CSA. And I know that stands for community-supported agriculture. How important for a market gardener, I guess, or a farmer in our area, it doesn't matter to have CSAs. I know I had one for a while, and it was so much fun as a consumer to be part of that farm. I felt like I knew the farmer, and plus it was really fun to open up the container every week and see what I was going to eat. But how important is it to have that support ahead of time? How does it work? Any one of you.
Oh, okay. We're looking at each other.
Diane.
Green Tree Naturals has the, I think we're one of the oldest CSAs in the region. We started in 1995. And it's a different kind of relationship because our customers prepay for their season share of the garden, which gives us startup money for seed money. It gives us money for doing all the things that we need to do to get the garden going in the beginning of the season. So it's very much a trust relationship. And some of our, we have a few members that have been with us for 15 years, and we've been doing it a long time. So it's, we've kind of gone on and off with our CSA as far as the membership of how many members we have, but a part of it is that there's a newsletter that has serving suggestions and stories about what's going on in the farm. And it's really about creating a relationship. And truly, since we started doing the CSA, to me, one of the finest moments of being a small acreage farmer is having somebody introduce me as, this is my farmer.
Oh.
Or going to a meal and going, this is Green Tree Natural Salad, or this is Bountiful Organics garlic, or whatever. I love going to events where it's all about the food and it's where the food was grown. And over the years, I've certainly found myself being a bit of a, well, more than a bit, quite a food snob in relationship to who grew the food and where it came from. But that's a part of community-supported agriculture, whether that's through a CSA or a farm stand or the farmer's market. It's a commitment of the community to support the farmer from seed to plate.
The local farmer. And Paul, is there a version of that in your dairy business?
There definitely is. As in full disclosure, Julie here is one of our on-farm customers. And the way we do that, we don't have a CSA, but we have a system where we have people on a reservation schedule for a certain quantity for a certain day every single week. And so we literally have a schedule with however many names are on for that day and the quantity that they're getting, and that's what we bottle for. So it's like a CSA. A lot of those are actually paying in advance, like a month in advance, 2 months in advance. Hopefully they don't go in arrears. That sometimes happens. but that's how we're doing that. But we're also combining it, obviously, with a retail operation where we're obviously getting our milk out to a much wider audience. And that part of our customer base is a little bit more discreet or random to me. I don't necessarily know who in the community is consuming our milk, although occasionally I'll meet people in town who say, oh, we buy your milk, and it's great. Obviously, in cases with our on-farm customers, I see those people all the time. We have a relationship. In fact, I'm also a local CPA, and I've actually gotten clients through that where you know, you have more than just a farm relationship with them.
It's, again, back to the relationship basis. And Pat?
Our CSA at Bountiful Organics is a little bit different. We bill on a monthly basis. Until last summer, I was doing a great deal of the work myself with a few volunteers sprinkled in and out. And it was really hard for me to commit or be able to make that promise up front to be able to support folks, you know, throughout the summer. Sure, the money would look nice up front, but again, you got to be as good as your word, and I just didn't know that I could fulfill that. But having Tanner now on board, and Charlie Kramer also has joined the farm, so we are starting out this season with a power team.
And, so it's a bit of a balancing act. You need to know that you can provide for the CSA folks, but at the same time, they're helping you provide your funding and get you going for the year. It sounds like it's important.
Yes, it is.
And another thing about the CSA is it's a locally based economic model of food distribution. We've talked about how powerful food is, and that food is about the relationships that are built and sustained through the growing and sharing of food. So I see CSA models as strengthening those relationships.
Great.
So just a little follow-up question. You work with your CSAs providing your customers through that model, but you also have to have the food every Saturday and Wednesday at the farmer's market. And by the way, the farmer's market opens May 6th. We're 2 months away. Yay! So it like you said, Pat, it does take knowing that you can meet those quantities of food to fill your CSA box every week. So starting out slowly, Diane, it sounds like you've got a handle on that one after all these years of farming.
It's something new every year, but we've certainly changed how we do our CSA. We used to start the beginning of May. Now we wait until we're coming into the peak of harvest, and we start our CSA later in the season. We usually don't start until July, because if we start early on, it's just like when you go to the farmer's market in May and June, it's, everybody has the same thing. It's greens, greens, and more greens, which are great. But I want to make sure that our customers are getting a good variety. So we have pushed our start date back, and we go into the peak of the season for the shares that we offer.
That makes sense. We've talked about your gardening practices and your businesses, and I'm curious to know how the beginning home gardener might best work their way into doing a bit of gardening. I'm interested in knowing what you've learned from your beginning gardeners. Have they mainly begun by purchasing produce from you all and then starting their own gardens, or does it normally work the other way? Do you normally find that most of your customers are also gardening on their own? Pat?
It really does my heart good when I see the faces of people that come and they are ready to brag about what they're able to grow for themselves. And most people, I would say, do not grow enough to meet their own personal demands. We also grow a lot of seed, both for a big seed company back east and also for the farm. And one of the things that really charges me up is when I see someone come back to me that has grown or purchased garlic seed from us, and they have finally grown enough, and they've finally gotten big enough, and they'll show up with a big smile on their face and announce that they no longer need to buy seed. Then I've done my work.
So that's a nice attitude. It doesn't take away from your business. There ends up being more food. People are learning.
I can't grow enough garlic. No, I'm happy to teach it, though, because we can't grow it all.
Diane, how about you? Do you find that you end up with lots of beginning gardeners becoming more experienced gardeners after knowing you?
Well, I teach gardening, and I teach organic gardening workshops on the farm. So people come to me to learn how to grow gardens. And in the wintertime, I teach sustainable agriculture. So that's a given. If they're coming to spend time at our farm, we're a teaching farm, and that's a large component of it. But I agree with Pat, that point, whether people are buying vegetable starts from us in the spring and come back to say, oh my gosh, I've never had a tomato like that or never had garlic like that. That's pretty exciting to see that. I think a big part of people seeing what varieties we can grow by coming to the farmer's market and seeing the local food also gives them perspectives of, once they start trying a garden, they often find that they're pretty limited just by their microclimate of where they live and what they can do. But I'd love to see every lawn in town dug up and a vegetable garden planted in it myself, because there really is nothing more magical than planting a seed and having that turn into something that goes on your dinner plate. So I encourage that absolutely for people to grow their own food whenever they can, but most likely they're going to be supporting the local farmers as well.
And you do not have to have an acre, a half acre, even a lot. You can grow herbs in a flower pot on your deck.
There you go. Well, unless you're Paul, and then I don't think you're bringing a cow home to the backyard.
My general advice to people who want to do their own dairy is don't try this at home. Actually, the reality is most people who get the idea of doing dairy, they'll try it with goats. And 90% are out in 5 years.
It's a lot.
It's
of
a
work.
Huge lifestyle change.
Yes, it is. Susie.
So we've backed up to the Lawns to Garden project. I think in Missoula, Montana, they have a project called 1,000 Lawns to Garden. And that's kind of the home gardener is a farmer in a sense. But let's back up a little further, even to children. How important is it that children and students, I know that on April 22nd, I'm going to have a show on the morning show, and it's called Garden Talk. And one of my guests is Michelle Murphy, who does the school garden project in the public school. But I just want to hear what your thoughts on children learning to garden.
And Tanner, you might be a good person to start. I understand you're a bit involved with that.
Yeah, I would just like to start off by saying that Michelle Murphy is doing great work all around Bonner County, as well as the Sandpoint Community Resource Center, creating committees to tackle these ideas. I think connecting the youth with farming is a great educational proponent. The power of soil is amazing, and I continue to see the power, you know, as a 23-year-old. And I think that integrating it into our educational or into our schools will help our community, will help the retention rates, kids being invested in their own future, seeing the power of growing a seed and caring for that seed.
Well, I asked one of the students that is part of the garden project at Farm and Stidwell, actually. I had him here in the studio, and I said, Alex, what is gardening to you? Tell me something. He said, growing food is magic. So for an 8-year-old, or maybe he was 10 by then, to say that, and he said it with complete conviction, to a child, it's magic. So bravo for teaching children to garden.
Definitely.
Kind of says it all about kids. So I'd like to move on to the next area, and I'd like to hear a little bit about a day in the life of a CSA organic farmer and then a day in the life of a dairy farmer. I know it must change from day to day, but just give us a slice.
A day out on the farm. Wake up at the crack of dawn always, followed by hours and hours and hours of work with no sleep. No, I'm kidding. Usually we start the day with a farm team check-in where we go over the goals of the day, support needed for those goals. I think a big thing we always make sure to do is switch up the farm activities, whether it's messing around in the high tunnel, the production center, or out on the fields. We don't want to overexhaust ourselves.
Slow and steady wins the race.
Yeah, definitely.
That's right. Paul, tell us about a day at the Herndon family.
So that would vary seasonally. In the summer, the cows are out on pasture, and so we're moving cows. We have to bring them in for milking, and then they go right back out. We aren't like what most people have in their heads of what a dairy is, where you're getting up at 3 in the morning. I have teenagers, and they don't get up at 3 in the morning. And in fact, our son, who's an adult now, he's basically our primary employee. He milks the cows at about 9 or 10. The important thing with cows is that they're just milked on a regular schedule, and so in our case, it roughly equates to every 12 hours. But if they're out on pasture, we might go 11 and 13 or something like that. Just something that the cows know to anticipate because they're creatures of routine. So in the winter, there's a lot of cleaning, a lot of feeding, watering, milking, cleaning, feeding, watering, milking. In the summer, the cows, there's no cleaning because they're out on the fields, and then the turkeys take care of it, and any other birds we have out there. There's still watering. We run an irrigation system, so there is that. There's moving cows, but there's no feeding, no cleaning because they're taking care of it themselves. But then there's always still the milking, there's the bottling, there's the delivery. Mm-hmm. So a lot going on there.
And beyond that, you're moving cows around from field to field. And what was this I heard about? Birds, ducks, chickens?
We also have ducks on the farm. We produce a small amount of eggs, which are sold locally. And they move around in portable pens. And occasionally when we need to work out, the fields we got were pretty abused, as in conventional farming, and they had produced a lot of knapweed and tansy, noxious weeds. And we discovered the best way to deal with noxious weeds in pasture is actually to run a concentrated bird operation over it, where we use those 2-foot-high, 10-by-12 chicken tractors filled with chickens. They have a devastating effect on tansy and a long-term good effect on tansy. It's amazing what I've learned about that. So we do occasionally have broilers that we're running throughout the fields to take care of weedy areas.
All that work, and then that's where they end up.
Oh, exactly. Well. And we also are a haven for the wild turkey population, unfortunately.
Yes.
But it's good in the summer. It's terrible in the winter.
Well, it's a it sounds like banker's hours for this dairy farm, but still quite busy. Diane, yeah. What's a day like for you?
It certainly goes through its rotations depending on what time of year it is. And it's always during the growing season. It's always getting the watering going. Two or three days a week, it's always harvesting, washing, weighing, bagging produce for market restaurants, Winter Ridge, our farm stand, bagging for our CSAs. We always do deliveries set days on Wednesdays and Fridays. During the summer season, depending on, we have our on-farm organic gardening workshops every other Monday, and then we do a fair amount of on-farm research with the University of Idaho and Washington State University. So we have grad students coming for different times throughout the season doing their projects. So it's variable, but it's consistently the same. I always say we had no idea when we became farmers that we would only have to work half time. That's 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Sounds like a consistent message I'm hearing. Plenty of work.
You got to love what you do.
Yeah, and it sounds like all three of you really do love it. I'd like to ask you how the work has changed over the years for you all. Paul.
Well, for us, it's just continually getting busier, but it's also coming up with methods that deal with the higher volume. So we have a huge capital investment. We have a lot of equipment that we haven't installed yet that costs thousands upon thousands of dollars. And so for us, what's changing is how we're processing. We have a great bottling machine that's not hooked up yet because it needs the building. I have everything but the building that it all needs to go into. And so bulk tanks, et cetera, how we're going to be doing things in the future is evolving because of you go from a handful of cows to, like I say, suddenly this summer I'm looking at grazing 16 out there. A lot of those are young cows. But
yeah, so it's a systems management you're trying to work out for the local economy because the local economy is demanding more and more of your milk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we were running sheep with our cows because we have enough land to sustain a lot more cows than we have now. And we got rid of those last fall because now we've got so many cows. So even that changes the mix of what you're grazing. And then getting rid of sheep is going to change how the pastures respond. And so we have to adapt to that.
Lots to think about, lots to plan. And Diane, you've come from a small farm to a pretty large farm now. You've grown over the years.
We started out with a small garden and ended up growing more than what we could eat. So it kind of started out just as a hobby of selling at the farmer's market. And we just kept expanding from maybe a third acre to 2.5 acres. And it morphed into something that it is today. But the big difference is the learning curve. When we first started out, we both knew how to grow, but doing contracts for people and changing that. But I think the biggest part that changed for us is, aside from increasing our production over the years, was changing to meet the need for the educational purpose of what we do. Because I have as much passion for teaching organic and sustainable ag as I do for living that lifestyle and doing what we do. So education is a huge component of what we do on our farm now.
You've added an education component that takes up time and is really satisfying. What a great change. And Pat, how have things changed for you over the years?
Well, to be honest, after making thousands of mistakes, I try to implement more and more solutions every year. That's where about 95% of my formal education has come from. And I really enjoy sharing those tips to other folks, whether you're starting out or been at it a while. If I can save anyone some of the grief that I've done to my body parts, then that makes me happy. It makes me feel good. Seed is really my next step. And with the addition of Tanner and Charlie to really steamroll the operation, it frees me up to maybe not work 18-hour days, 8 days a week, and do some things that really matter beyond the moment. I mean, growing the food, of course, is very rewarding, and being able to donate food is even more rewarding. But the seed aspect is so important, and there's not enough organic seed on the market now. So,
Pat and I were talking before the interview began, and something she told me was that she's enjoyed having these young strapping lads who've been learning new methods, and she's been sharing experience. So it sounds like that's been a energetic and fulfilling trade-off for you.
Oh, I can't even put it into words, the changes that the Tanner himself has made for the farm. And we brought Charlie, his roommate and good buddy, back from Organicology conference that we went through. So we're now a powerful threesome.
The future's the young folks, isn't
that's,
it?
That's
we need
a fact.
Them for these kinds of farms. Well, I've got a last question for you all. And it would be, how do you see the future of your businesses? Paul?
I see us just continuing to grow till we get to the point where we're past fluid milk, as it's called, and then producing other products. And just speaking to the young people, there's a lot of young people in this country who want to learn grass-based dairying. And there's a great website out there where I can advertise those internship positions. And I see ourselves probably hosting 2 or 3 interns every year so that they can learn how to do this and then take it back to where they live or where they want to be.
What is it? Do you have the...
It's called eagerfarmer.com.
Great. That's a good one.
Great site. It was started by the wife of Daniel Salatin, who's Joel Salatin's son, who has Polyface Farm in Virginia.
A great pedigree. Mm-hmm. Diane, where's your future?
Well, I just got my Medicare card this past week, and my husband is 68, so we're coming to a place where everyone is always asking us when we will retire, and I always jokingly say farmers never retire, other than I was tired yesterday and I'll be tired again tomorrow. But that said, we will probably keep on farming for as long as we are physically able, but shift more. We've been shifting into seed production as well and moving more into expand the educational component and mentorship programs. And one of the programs I've been working on for the last 10 years with the university is teaching farmers how to be teachers, how to be better mentors. So we'll continue with that and try to back off a little bit on some of the physical aspects, but we'll farm as long as we can possibly do it.
Teachers can go even longer than farmers. Sounds like a good plan. And Pat, how about your future?
Well, again, touching on seed production, a few years back, I had some broccoli that we munched on it a bit, but then it went to seed. And normally, it's kind of a negative thing when your broccoli all of a sudden bolts on you. But when I saw the beautiful beneficials that were attracted to those blossoms, this little bit of broccoli was not in my way, so I just let it go. And it turned into an amazing experience and kind of bit me into, hey, I could do this and not be so physically demanding. And also the size needed to create seed crops. It's a lot less land that you need to be able to grow seed.
And as Susie said, magical. Seeds are magical. What a great future that you could move
they
into.
Are.
And then Tanner will have to take over the CSA. Where do you see yourself, Tanner?
Well, I see the future of Bountiful Organics being bountiful. Like Pat said, we just hired our first intern this year, so we've expanded quite a bit in the last year. I see a lot of potential for the future.
And you've got a long future ahead of you, so I wish you well in that.
Thank you.
Well, we're finishing our interview with Sustainable Local Gardeners. If you're just joining us at the end of the interview, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. If you missed some or all of this interview, you can listen to it later at your leisure via our podcast, and you'll find that at krfy.org. I want to thank you all for joining us this morning. It's been a great talk. I feel like we've just touched the surface. We might have to have you all back at the end of the season and find out how things went. Thank you, Pat and Tanner.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for the odd man out, Paul. Paul, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
And thank you, Susie.
Oh, you're welcome. I just want to say we'll see all of you at the farmers market May 6th.
We'll be there.
Can't wait. Beginning of the Farmers Market. Thank you all and have a great week.
And that concludes our pre-recorded morning show with our three local sustainable gardeners. Because I didn't offer contact information during their interviews, I'd like to at least get you started on that. For Paul Herndon, all three of you will be able to find online, but Paul Herndon can be found by searching Pleasant Meadow Creamery. It's an easy one. Diane Wood can be reached by searching for Green Tree Naturals. And finally, Pat Van Valkenburg can be found by searching Bountiful Organics. And all three are local, so you'll want to find them in the Sandpoint area. This was a great interview and a rather lengthy one, which is going to preclude me going through upcoming events this week. I'll just mention tomorrow's morning show, which will be Susie Prez and Jack Peterson. Their guests will be the Lake Pondere School District Superintendent Sean Woodward and Chief Financial Officer Lisa Hales. They will be sharing details of the upcoming March 14th supplemental school levy. So if you have questions about that, I would recommend that you tune in. And Thursday's morning show will be with host Jack Peterson and his guest, Lauren Pellin, musician and musical historian. And that will be the rest of the morning shows for this week. We'll go out with a song, an appropriate one for this morning's topic, Cisco Houston with Farmer's Lament.
I've pruned all the apples and haul brush away, manured the currants and seeded